Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Litigation Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, September 25th, 2015, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group teleforum conference call on class action cases in the upcoming Supreme Court term. My name is Katie McClendon, and I'm the Director of Publications at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also note that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome our expert, Warren Postman, Associate Chief Counsel for Litigation at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. A more complete bio of our speaker was provided to you in the notice of the call. And with that, Mr. Postman, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, and hi, everyone. As you all know, if you dialed into this call, one of the big stories this upcoming Supreme Court term is going to involve class actions. The court's already agreed to hear three potentially major cases, and then it's also got a couple other cert petitions that are waiting in the wings that could have a significant impact in the area. So I thought I'd start off today by describing each of the cases that the court's granted and then touch on some themes and issues to watch that cut across one or more of these cases, and then finally I'll open it up for questions. Before I get to that, though, let me just give you, 15 seconds of background on the Chamber Litigation Center. Everything I say will be offered in my personal capacity, but it seems fair to give you some context on my perspective. So the Litigation Center where I work is an affiliate of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce that advocates for the interests of business in the courts, and we do that basically in two ways. We file lawsuits on behalf of the chamber and its members challenging regulations, usually federal regulations. The Noel Cannon case, the recess appointment case in the Supreme Court last term is an example of that. And then we also file a lot of amicus briefs in other cases representing the views of the business community. And as part of that amicus effort, we filed briefs supporting review in each of the merits cases I'll discuss and then filed again on the merits. So with that context, I'll talk a bit about the three merits cases that have already been granted. The three cases are Campbell Ewald v. Gomez, Tyson Foods v. Bupacchio, and Spokio v. Robbins. So I'll just take them in the order they're being argued. The first of these that's being argued on October 14th is Campbell Ewald v. Gomez, and that involves what you might call the case of the headless class action. Essentially, the issue is if a defendant offers the named plaintiff in a class action full relief on his claim before any class is certified, can that class action keep going even though the only plaintiff who's in the case already can get everything he's seeking without the litigation? So in this particular case, the plaintiff brought claims under the Telephone Consumer Protection Act, the TCPA. That's a statute that gives statutory penalties for it's $500 subject to tripling in certain cases for unauthorized phone calls or messages. And the defendant here, Campbell Ewald, was sending text messages on behalf of the U.S. Navy as part of a recruiting effort. The plaintiff said that he, along with a class of 100,000 individuals, had received unwanted texts. And depending on how you do the calculations, the $500 sounds small, but with 100,000 class members and trebling damages and multiple texts, it gets into the hundreds of millions of dollars in potential damages on behalf of the class. So Campbell Ewald offered the plaintiff full judgment under Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 68. There's a procedure where you can offer it to just give up, and offered the full amount of the highest statutory damages possible for the individual plaintiff, plus court costs, plus agreed to an injunction. So said, we give up. We'll give you everything you want. But the plaintiff rejected this offer, and the reason, of course, is because the plaintiff was working with plaintiff's lawyers to bring the broader class action. And so Campbell Ewald, the defendant, argued that no, you can't keep suing if you've got everything you want. Your case, your claim individually is moot. The district court and the Ninth Circuit rejected that argument. They essentially said that because the plaintiff had rejected the offer, he hadn't gotten relief yet, and so the suit could proceed. So the petition, as it comes to the court, actually breaks the analysis down into two steps. So it presents two questions. The first asks whether a case becomes moot and, you know, therefore is beyond the power of Article III federal courts to decide when an individual plaintiff receives an offer of complete relief on his claim. And then the second question is whether the answer changes if the plaintiff is pursuing a class action, if the claims are asserted on behalf of a class. I'll note the case also includes a separate question about sovereign immunity for government contractors, but I'll skip over that since that doesn't really go to the class action issue. So what are the arguments here? On the first question, you know, just looking at the individual, the defendant's making sort of very basic federal courts arguments about what a case or controversy is. You know, there's case law going back 100 years saying that for a federal court to hear a case, you need a case or controversy. That means the parties have to be adverse and they need a real stake in the outcome, and that this stake needs to persist at all stages of the litigation. So given that sort of black letter law, here, Campbell-Ewald argues, there's no adversity. I've given you everything you want. What are we litigating for? So the other side responds that, no, I haven't accepted your offer, and that therefore becomes a legal nullity. The court hasn't entered it. I still don't have what I'm asking for, and you can't force me to take it in this way. So right now I'm sitting with nothing, and I have a stake in the litigation. I guess in some sense it breaks down to whether you look at it as a formal legal matter, what the plaintiff has, versus as a functional practical matter. You know, as a practical matter, they're going to get everything, but they don't have it in their hands yet. That's the first question. That's a lot of what the parties focus on, in part because the second question, this question of whether if the named plaintiff's claim is moot, can he proceed on behalf of a class action? That's largely been answered in a case called General Healthcare Corporation. The Supreme Court took that case actually to decide this same question in the context of it's a collective action under the Fair Labor Standards Act. Those are effectively a class action. They proceed in very similar way. And the court couldn't reach the entire question because the courts below had just assumed that the named plaintiff's claim was indeed moot. So they assumed it was moot and then said over a very strident dissent by Justice Kagan that once we know that the named plaintiff's claim is moot, then he can't proceed on behalf of a class action. So a lot of that work is already done. There's broader policy implications, certainly, in this case, and those are raised a lot by the amici who filed. The Solicitor General on behalf of the United States filed in support of the plaintiff, and I'll touch on those a bit more once I've addressed the other cases, because I think those policy issues sort of overlap in each of the cases. So the second case, and this one will be argued on November 2nd, is Spokio v. Robbins. And this one I think of as a gotcha class action. The essential question here is if a federal court has jurisdiction to hear a case where the plaintiff doesn't allege what you would normally think of as an injury in fact, and instead only asserts that he was subject to a technical statutory violation. So, you know, a great example of this, and this was presented in a petition that a lot of us were watching a couple years ago, is there's a federal statute that requires two forms of notification before you get charged out-of-network ATM fees. You know, if you're not using your bank, you got to pay $2 to take your cash out. So a plaintiff brought a suit under that statute saying that this network of ATMs didn't have the sticker on the ATM. But of course, to get the money out of the ATM, you had to hit the button saying, yes, I know I'll be charged and I agree. So there was no plausible argument that the plaintiff had been injured in any real way, had been deceived or tricked. It was a pure gotcha that the sticker wasn't on the ATM. The court didn't take that case, unfortunately. It also, I'd note, a couple years before that, had the question in a case called First American v. Edwards and had dismissed it as improvidently granted. So it decided to review it, had briefing, and then punted and said, "We regret taking this case. We're not answering it." So there's some history here, but the court now has the issue again in the Spokio case. So what's the context here? This is a Fair Credit Reporting Act case, and as some of you may know, Spokio operates what they call a people search engine. They basically aggregate a lot of information from other sources on the internet. So if you want to find out about someone, you can get it in one place. Robbins brought a class action. He alleged false information about him and, you know, wanted to proceed on behalf of anyone in the same situation. The twist was that the false information here arguably put him in a better light than was true. That is, it suggested that he had more education, was better off financially than he actually was. So I suppose you could argue that that is still an injury. You know, employers might be upset if the information is inaccurate. But the Ninth Circuit simplified matters. It just held that it didn't have to find any injury. It wasn't gonna bother with the question of whether there was harm there. It just held that the mere fact that Congress created a private cause of action and created these statutory penalties meant that there was standing. So what are the arguments in this case? Again, sort of federal courts 101 is that the courts have jurisdiction to hear a case or controversy. As I mentioned, part of that is adversity. Another part of it is that there needs to be what the courts call an injury in fact. It needs to be a concrete, certain injury to the plaintiff that can be redressed by the courts. In a number of cases, the Supreme Court has also said that the injury has to be independent of the litigation. So you can't sort of bootstrap your way into an injury by saying, if I win, I'm going to get attorney's fees. And the court has also said that these constitutional minimums can't be changed by Congress. So if you take all of those separate principles and put them together, in this case, the defendants have a pretty strong argument that you can't let a statute here, you know, this Fair Credit Reporting Act and the statutory penalties circumvent or create an injury where absent the statute, you wouldn't have had one. And it's pretty clear that without the statute, there would have been no injury, at least as the Ninth Circuit assumed the facts to be. So what did the other side say? The other side points to a lot of history, and they say that standing and this concept of case or controversy and injury in fact is really a way of describing the sort of cases that historically the courts were expected to decide. And if you look historically at the founding era, there were a lot of causes of action under common law, and then the first Congress enacted some that allowed individuals to proceed without an injury in fact. Defamation, they argue, is one where there's certain instances of per se defamation where you don't have to prove any injury. Qui tam statutes where the government says, if you find out about a certain violation, defrauding the government, or there's analogs in other contexts, you can sue, you can get a statutory penalty, a recovery, or a certain percentage of the government's recovery. You, the relator, the one bringing the private party, don't need any injury, and so they'll point to that history and say that this is really no different than a defamation suit or trespass or qui tam statutes. The defendant Spokio sort of tries to rebut that. They do a lot of historical work in their brief trying to say that there were narrow established presumptions where common law courts would effectively presume injury, but that the general rule was still that there needed to be an injury. And that can't be ignored in the modern era where, if you let these statutes count as injury, Katie bar the door. There's really tons of these statutes that create civil penalties that don't necessarily bring any injury. So this issue, it's not, as you may have inferred as I discussed this, it's not specific to class actions. This would happen in an individual case as well, but it really takes on added weight in the context of a class action, and I'll talk about that more in a moment. So let me just turn to the last case that will be argued on the merits so far, and that's Tyson Foods v. Bupacchio, and that will be argued on November 10th. So this is a trial by formula case. The plaintiffs are arguing they work at a pork processing facility, and they claim they weren't fully compensated under the Fair Labor Standards Act because Tyson didn't count the time when they were putting on and taking off protective gear. So the trick with this is the plaintiffs brought a class action on behalf of 3,000 employees doing 420 distinct jobs, and each of these jobs required different gear, different setup times, and so it would have been hard to prove that all of them worked the same amount of time. It just wasn't true. So the plaintiffs used a statistical sample, and they sampled about 10% of the workforce and averaged it out. They effectively conceded that not only would some of the plaintiffs and some members of the class work fewer hours than average, some of them would have not worked any overtime at all, and so essentially were uninjured. But the district court and the Eighth Circuit basically said that's close enough for government work. We'll average it out and apply the average to the whole class. So the petition before the court breaks this down into two related questions. The first is whether under Rule 23 of the federal rules, can differences among class members be ignored and a class certified with statistical averages that assume everyone's identical to the average? And the second question, relatedly, is under Rule 23, can you certify a class where the class contains hundreds of members who were not injured and had no legal right to damages? So, these arguments, those QPs sort of are allude to the legal arguments. As many of you may know, under Rule 23, to certify a class action, a plaintiff needs to show that there's common issues and that when you're seeking damages, these common issues to the class predominate and that there's not, in other words, there's not a bunch of individualized issues that will take up more time than deciding the common issues. Relatedly, there's a constitutional point that, as we talked about, as I mentioned in Spokio, if you can't proceed in court when you're not actually injured, then one would think that individuals who weren't injured can't proceed as part of a class. That putting these people who don't have standing to be in court into a larger group shouldn't somehow give them a right to be there. Again, there's broader policy themes here, which I'm about to get to, but I'll just touch on a couple petitions that if you're interested in class actions, you should keep on your radar. One is a case called Walmart v. Braun. This is a very similar case to Tyson. It's big. It's a couple hundred thousand employees who were awarded $150 million based on allegations that they were denied rest breaks and had to work off the clock. The difference between Tyson and Walmart is that Walmart arose in state court, and since Rule 23 and all its requirements don't apply in state court, Walmart is raising similar arguments but directly under the Due Process Clause. They're arguing that this sort of trial by formula that assumes everybody's average and doesn't allow the defendant to point out those individuals who weren't injured denies the defendant's due process because they're not able to present defenses as to each individual. That case has actually, we think, been held pending Tyson. So it was up ready to be decided at the cert stage for a while, and from the docket it looks like it's held. What's interesting about that is that, as I said, it raises due process issues. Tyson raises the similar arguments directly under Rule 23. As a strictly legal matter, Tyson case doesn't need to control the Walmart case. The court could hold that the class was improperly certified under Rule 23, and it wouldn't mean there's a due process violation. However, the fact that the court's holding it, I think, reveals that the court sees the common thread, and if the court decides Tyson in favor of the defendant and then remands Walmart for further consideration, that may be a hint or a signal that the court thinks there's not only a Rule 23 problem, but a due process problem. And of course, the significance of that is that the rule will apply in state courts as well as federal courts. So the last petition I'll mention briefly, which has not actually been filed yet, is a case called Mullins v. Direct Digital. I say petition because I suspect that one will be filed. This is a case that was recently decided by the Seventh Circuit, and that court itself acknowledged that there was a clear split among the circuits. So if you want a pithy label for this one, I'd call it the no receipt class action, because the issue is essentially if you're suing on behalf of a bunch of consumers that you have no way to identify, can you proceed in a class? The facts here involve claims that the defendant misrepresented that its product would relieve joint discomfort. There's other ones. There's one going on in the Ninth Circuit about a can of tomato sauce that it said all natural, and it wasn't really all natural. And the issue with these is, even assuming that the plaintiff can prove a misrepresentation and some violation, how are you going to go about finding who bought the can of tomato sauce? People probably don't save their receipts for that. The company has no way to track it. You know, and from the company's perspective, the risk is that you're going to let people just come in with an affidavit, you know, file a piece of paper saying you bought the tomato sauce and you can get whatever damages. And that, of course, there's no way for the defendant to test that. Some courts have held that Rule 23 impliedly has what you'd call an ascertainability requirement, that you need to be able to identify the class, and that on this logic, these sort of no-receipt class actions where there's no way to identify the class members fail Rule 23. The Seventh Circuit held that, well, we're not going to say that there's such a requirement. We may take it into account when we're talking about whether a class action is a superior vehicle, which is another requirement of Rule 23, but we're not going to have any hard and fast rule. So that's another important one to watch that has divided the circuits. So now to some common themes that I see among these cases. So I'll give the perhaps cynical view first, and then the less cynical way to look at these after. If you want to take the slightly more cynical view, you can look at the incentives of the parties in these cases and see how they sort of all fit together. And I think that in each of these cases, plaintiffs' lawyers are trying to do two things. They're trying to make the class as big as possible, and they're trying to make the class as easy to certify as possible. And of course, the end result, if you get both of those things, is a big settlement, which leads to big attorney's fees. So Spokio, I think, illustrates both of these very clearly. These class actions for statutory damages can be huge, into the hundreds of millions of dollars. The TCPA, although that's the particular statute at issue in Campbell Ewald, as I said, the damages there are in the hundreds of millions. So you get a large class action, but the other thing is, because you can sue based solely on the statutory violation and don't rely on any injury to individuals, you strip out all the individualized issues. And that means that that the requirements of Rule 23 are almost satisfied automatically. It's an insta-class. So that's a lot of what's at stake in Spokio. Tyson is also about ease of certification, of course. You know, trial by formula makes it easier to certify the class. You, again, with an average, strip out all the individualized issues. I also think it's about making a bigger class, though, or bigger damages. And this isn't directly presented in the case, but I think there's a subtext here, which is if you let these class actions be tried by statistics, it's very easy to manipulate. Plaintiffs can shop around for an expert. that will do a statistical analysis, you know, cherry-picking the sample, various statistical techniques to make the number as big as possible. And if the judge at the trial level is not willing to dig in on the experts before the class certification stage, then you're facing a class with potential massive damages, and companies really face a tough choice litigating those to conclusion, even if they think the statistical analysis is flawed, you know, and often are just compelled to settle. And then Campbell Ewald as well, you know, having a named plaintiff is often in these cases a challenge. You know, the plaintiff's lawyers can find one or two, but if there's not sometimes a real outcry, then having the named plaintiff's claims mooted means they can't go forward with the class action. So again, it's a way to make proceeding with a class easier. On the other side, plaintiffs will call the defendant's position in Campbell Ewald a pickoff tactic. You know, they're essentially implying that the company is going to keep picking off one plaintiff after another so that no class action can ever be certified. I think the simple counterargument to that is that if there really is a broad class of injured parties, then the company's not, as a practical matter, going to be able to do that. If, you know, giving full relief up to the maximum statutory allowable plus costs were done, you know, for a class of 1,000 people or 100,000 people, it really starts to add up. So in some ways, I think the elegance or the interesting part about Campbell Ewald is that it shows, it sort of puts the proof to the class action claim. I think if the defendant is offering full relief and there isn't a swarm of people stepping up to take it, then it sort of suggests that there's not a huge mass of injured parties standing behind the named plaintiff. So I mentioned the slightly less cynical view. Maybe that's not the right way to phrase it, but I think that another way to think about this is that the two sides in these cases really reflect two different worldviews when it comes to class actions. So on the one hand, and this is, you know, the view associated with the plaintiff's bar, is that class actions could be seen as a way to regulate through private attorneys general. And given this good regulatory effect, you could think that courts should make sure that there needs to be a substantial amount of class actions. And part of doing that should be, you know, let's be close enough for government's work. Let's not, if a class roughly approximates the real world, we don't need to be perfect. This is just sort of a practical way to get a regulatory effect. And that's the point you can see in the complaints about pickoff litigation in Campbell Ewald. You know, the implication is that we can't let these class actions stall. And you can see them as a form of regulation in Spokio. This is a way, you know, the idea is this is a way for private parties to enforce these various technical statutes. And you can see the rough approximation idea in Tyson Foods. I guess the single subtext to all of this is that, and maybe this is a little too pejorative, but is that there's a God-given right to bring a class action, and there's a fear that this court's cases, or that the court's cases this term, are going to put that at risk. So the other view, and I don't think I've hidden that it is mine, is that the class action device is an exception to the ordinary means of litigation. It's a relatively recent innovation, and it was and should be intended to efficiently aggregate individual claims that are themselves valid in their own right. And it should be used, I think the key thing is, it should be used only to establish claims of a representative plaintiff that will necessarily establish the claims of everyone else. So the key flaw in Tyson, for example, is that if you establish the claims of the named plaintiff, it doesn't at all mean that by that same proof you've established the claims of everyone else in the class. Spokio, as I said, it's sort of a dodge around that by saying, well, let's not even look to whether there's injury. And Campbell Ewald, in a practical way, is also trying to say, let's not get bogged down in whether everyone else is injured or cares. So I think that's, you know, from my perspective, what these cases have in common is they're trying to get away from that, what I see is the core model and the core purpose of class actions. So that's my initial overview of the cases and the themes I see in them. I've gone on for a bit, and I'm happy now to throw it open to questions if people have them.
Great. I'll now open the floor to our callers' questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, enter star and then pound. When we get to your request, you will hear a second prompt that will say, your microphone has been turned on, you have the floor. We'll be answering questions in the order in which they're received. Looks like we have one now, so we'll start it off.
Hello?
Thanks. Hi, Bob Fitzpatrick in Washington, D.C. A couple of real quick questions. If the defense wins, Spokio wins in that case, A, what's going to be the effect on tester cases where, you know, people who have, you know, deliberately go out to be, quote, injured and then sue as testers? Secondly, what's going to be the effect in False Claims Act cases that you discussed? And lastly, let's assume Dr. Carson, who's running for president, doesn't get the nomination and he goes back to practicing as a physician and announces that he will not hire a Muslim. But there is no Muslim who has applied for a job with Dr. Carson, and no God-fearing Muslim would after being told that. what's the effect on a lawsuit brought to enjoin his policy of not hiring Muslims?
Those are all good questions. So I'll take them in turn. The tester issue, the Havens Realty issue, is discussed in the case. It's certainly those are certainly cases that the plaintiffs rely on. I think that the respondent, the petitioner in this case, Spokio, has certainly given enough daylight that the court could rule for Spokio without overruling it. And the daylight is that in those cases, although I think one could argue that there wasn't an injury to the tester, the court in saying there was standing tried to come up with something, and it basically said that they're injured by being subjected to the discriminatory stereotype. I recognize that that's a slender distinction, but that I suppose it may go in part to the merits of Spokio's arguments, but I suspect that if the court were to rule for Spokio, it would not overrule Havens Realty. The QI-TAM issue, as you may know, this was addressed in part in a case a number of years ago called Vermont Agency of Natural Resources. The relator in that case, you know, sought civil penalties and damages on behalf of the government, and the defendant said there was no standing, echoing some of the themes Spokio is touching on. The court there upheld standing on the theory that the government itself is injured due to the damages from the fraud, from the lost money, and that what's going on in a False Claims Act case is the government is assigning that injury in fact. They're assigning the claim based on the injury in fact to the relator. I do think there's an open question in the False Claims Act context of what happens if you don't have injury to the government. So in the Vermont Agency of Natural Resources case, it was pretty clear on the facts that the government had lost money. And, you know, if you assign a claim based on a loss of money from the government to the private party, I think that gives the private party what it needs, what he needs to be in court. It's a harder case that I don't think the court has answered. What happens if you're proceeding on behalf of the government just for a violation of the law. The government, of course, you know, in criminal law and in a host of contexts, has enforcement authority. The government can sue for just a mere injury in law, a violation of the law. And so if that's what the government can do, I think there is an open question of whether the government can assign that authority. And frankly, there's, in addition to the Article 3 standing concerns, there's Article 2 concerns about, you know, separation of powers and the executive's obligation to take care that the law be faithfully executed. You know, can the executive outsource law enforcement duties to private citizens? So those are all open questions, I think. I suspect, again, that if Spokio were to win, the court would do so in a way that did not reach those. And one of the ways that it could hold open that question would be to point to the very specific history involving QI-TAM actions and say that, you know, an opinion going for Spokio would say that the innovations and the suits involved in Spokio and cases like that are of too recent vintage to be considered, you know, an exception to the normal rule, but that, you know, we don't have to address what happens in the QI-TAM context, which is, you know, dates back to the founding. And then, you know, some of what I've touched on is I think an answer to the Carson hypothetical, which is, you know, there would certainly be government enforcement authority. The EEOC can bring a charge without, in certain ways, without an injured party. But I think my answer would be that if no one applies and no one wants to apply, then they would probably not be injured. If someone wanted to apply but for the discrimination, they could say they were injured because they gave, you know, it was futile, and they may claim injury in that respect. But I don't know that there would be no remedy there.
Again, to ask a question, please push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone keyboard. Our next scheduled Teleforum conference call will be on Monday, September 28th, beginning at 1 o'clock Eastern Time. We'll be talking about going dark in the intersection of law enforcement and privacy interests. Make sure you consult the full schedule of our upcoming Teleforum conference calls on the Federalist Society's website, fedsoc.org. And visit our website to listen to podcasts of previously recorded Teleforum calls that you might have missed. Again, push the star and then the pound keys on your telephone. Well, while we wait to see if anybody else has a question, I was wondering, Mr. Postman, if you see the Supreme Court answering or issuing decisions in these cases that will occasion a huge change in the law of class actions, or is this the end of class actions potentially, or what do you foresee as the result of these cases this term?
Yeah, that's definitely a question, you know, we hear from reporters, and I think. Maybe there may be speculation in the news about whether that's going to happen. I don't want to call the outcome of these cases. I think that there's good arguments for the business side in all of them. I will say though that I think if we ran the table, I don't think it would be either the end of class action or I don't know that it'd necessarily be a huge sea change either. I think that a lot of what's going on in these cases, and we see it in other contexts as well, is, you know, the court will lay down some basic principles at a general level, but the plaintiff's bar and, in other contexts, you know, enforcement agencies will continually push to test those bounds and will come up with creative theories to expand liability. And so a lot of what we're doing in these cases, and we, the business community broadly, is trying to hold the line. And if these cases were all lost, I think that would be a sea change. I think, you know, Tyson Foods, for example, is really I think Tyson is asking the court to restate what was pretty clear in my mind after Comcast v. Barron a couple years ago, and that in turn was building off of basic principles in Walmart v. Dukes. So I think a lot of it is holding the line, you know, as is addressed in a lot of the amicus briefs. If these cases all went the plaintiff's way, I think it would open the floodgates. We'll have to wait and see what happens.
Our next question is up.
Yes, thanks for the presentation today. My question has to do with kind of the balance between the regulatory state, which has been expanding in the number of the last few years, and the necessity for expanding class actions, at least in the cases that you've discussed. And an argument could be made that, you know, with the presence of the CFPB and the expansion of the FTC and other similar government regulatory organizations, that there's not as much of a compelling need for class action remedies in general for those types of transactions which are consumer oriented. So I'd like to get your thoughts on that, and whether that's something that's, you know, is present in the briefs, where ever increasing regulatory function substitutes for expansion of class actions.
Yeah, thank you. I think that's totally right, and it is something we touched on in our brief and I think Spokio in particular and other briefs touched on it as well. That yeah, the regulatory argument for broad expansive class action law ignores a whole other source of regulatory enforcement, and that regulatory enforcement has only gotten broader. As you noted, it's in some ways, you know, there's the ability of the government to enforce, which provides an alternative reason to not expand class action law. There's also the fact that many of these statutes that create, you know, the FCFPB, they also create private causes of action with civil penalties that are quite significant when coupled with the class action model. So I talked about it a couple times with TCPA, how you quickly get up to, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in damages. So I think that the breadth of these statutes, of these private causes of action, and the extent of the penalties, again, counsel in favor of applying Rule 23 carefully and not just being reckless in what. When these class actions are certified, because it's a practical point. If you have a $100 million class action certified against, a $100 million company, the executives have to make a decision. Do we risk the entire fate of this company on this one case? And, you know, we may think we have the best arguments possible. We did nothing wrong. But it's a lot to ask executives, you know, if they can pay $3 million and get out of a case to literally bet the company on that. So there's the settlement pressures are pretty serious given the scope of these statutes, coupled with a sort of loose class action approach.
Well, if there are no further questions, Mr. Postman, do you want to give any closing remarks before we sign off?
I don't know that I have anything to add. If there aren't any questions, I appreciate everyone dialing in and the interest in these cases, and I'll certainly be watching with interest.
Great. Well, on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank Warren Postman for joining us today. Thank you also to our audience, and we welcome your feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Please do join us for our next teleforum on Monday, September 28th at 1 p.m. Eastern. Thanks.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.